This is Winston Churchill, speaking to you from number 10 Downing Street. Nothing lifts my spirits like a blast of Professor Buzzkill during our darkest hour. He busts myths and takes names like a squadron of Spitfires strafing enemy positions. And I'm totally stoked that he's here again to save Western civilization. So relax with your favorite whiskey and become enlightened.
Buzzkillers, it's 2018 here in the Buzzkill Bunker. It's 2018 where you are. And, of course, you've probably been overwhelmed with specials and anniversary shows on CNN, on MSNBC, on the BBC, all these anniversaries about 1968. 1968 in itself is a huge topic, and we're going to do more than one show on it. But today, we want to talk about the 1968 presidential election in the United States. And, of course, I can't do that on my own. So what do? I call our American history expert, Professor Nash, who came back to the bunker.
I'm always happy to come back.
You know, he makes these long trips. He suffers for his art.
I'm on retainer.
He's here.
He's here for his art. Yes, that's a phrase that's never been used with my name in the same sentence.
And, you know, we've been talking about this over the phone and over email and everything. We're planning for this show and reading new books about it. It is astounding how complicated this election is, and it's astounding how you still see aspects of it today.
Right, absolutely right. Yeah, and it's still an issue, and not just because it's this 50th anniversary. I have to point out that just the other day I was driving around, probably a week ago, and I actually saw on the back of a car a Nixon Now sticker.
Oh, right. A new one or one from 1960?
It was in really good shape, so and it looked like a reproduction, but it had the original font.
It was the slogan,
Nixon Now. It had the right colors.
That was the slogan in 68.
I'm thinking, wow, that was meant for historians. Yes, Nixon Now.
Yeah, the historical bumper sticker. How often do you see those? But again, and another thing we're talking about, this is not 1968, in quotation marks, is not just in the U.S.
Absolutely. And maybe we could do a whole show on that. We're not going to talk about it here. But one of the things that historians have focused on in recent years a lot is the extent to which 1968, quote unquote, was a global phenomenon.
Oh, sure.
And that the events in the United States were part of a much larger global context. You had tumultuous events, massive protests, massive violent events all over the world. You had the Prague Spring in Czechoslovakia, right?
Paris.
You had the Paris uprising, and this is hilarious to me, is that workers strike in sympathy to rebellious college students, right?
Yeah.
Which essentially led to massive political change in France.
Oh, yeah.
You had a massacre in Mexico City of young people by the security forces. You had big anti-Vietnam War protests in Japan.
Oh, right. I never think about
that.
And
in other countries like in Germany and Italy. I mean, this is a worldwide thing. It doesn't, for obvious reasons, doesn't get as much attention in the United States, but this really is part of something that is much bigger and that is interconnected. That a lot of these youth rebellions had an eye on what each other were doing and were inspired by each other. So it's not a coincidence that this sort of thing is happening all over the planet.
Yeah, so why don't we do another show later on in the year about the 1968 in a world context?
We could do that, certainly.
Yeah, but I'll tell you, there's plenty to bite off here in the 1968 U.S., just the presidential
just
election.
In the U.S. And once again, the domestic U.S. context is also crucial.
Yeah,
you cannot study 1968 in a vacuum. The 1968 is, quote-unquote, 1968 in part because of what has happened just leading up to it. For years by 1968, you have had already years of what you and I understand as, quote-unquote, the 60s. And by that I mean things like the youth rebellion, the so-called generation gap, the counterculture, student protest, civil rights struggle. We have had multiple summers of urban riots starting in 1964, right? And then after that, things like Watts and Newark in Detroit. These had all already happened before 1968.
And a lot of people think of Watts and Newark and Detroit as 1968, when in reality they were earlier.
Yeah. Watts was 65, and 67 was really the really bad summer before 1968. You also, in terms of the big sweep of U.S. history, one of the most important developments is already the national crime rate has begun to rise.
Yes, that's another thing that often gets buried.
All types of crime, including serious crimes and violent crime.
Right.
That historical increase in the crime rate is going to start around 1966. It's not going to subside until around 1990. And that is going to determine a lot of what goes on in American politics.
That's a long stretch.
It's a long stretch. The political impact of it continues long after the crime rate starts to decline in the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
We
mm-hmm.
still see it today, for example.
And people think there's more crime than
there
is.
Exactly. It has partly to do with local news, by the way. But things like mass incarceration are still a result of that historic increase in crime. Anyway, and famously, you also have, well before 68, you have the Vietnam War as this 800-pound gorilla in the room.
Getting larger and larger.
Our commitment deepening. The war still a stalemate at best, and it has provoked already before 1968 the largest anti-war movement we've ever seen in American history.
That's right. That's right. It's not like January 1st, 1968. Exactly. Everything starts. No,
probably. I'm pretty sure it's the biggest anti-war protest of the entire Vietnam War happens in October 1967 at the Pentagon.
Right.
It's a famous event, massive protest. That's all happened already. So who's presiding over this?
The presiding,
literally and figuratively, would be Lyndon B. Johnson.
Right.
Accidental president at first, right? Becomes president in 1963 when JFK is assassinated, is elected in his own right overwhelmingly in 1964.
Yes, that's huge landslide.
He's a very powerful president, in some ways one of the most powerful we've ever had. Mm-hmm. Very ambitious. Let's remind folks that he deliberately went by LBJ deliberately. To link himself to FDR in people's minds.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He wants to be on Mount Rushmore. First of all, he thinks Franklin Roosevelt belongs there.
Yeah, sure.
He
let's remind also that that's his political youth is under Franklin.
That's his
FDR.
Idol and his model is FDR, right? He actually worked for the New Deal and then went to Congress.
Yeah.
So he definitely was a big fan of FDR and sees himself as the next FDR.
Mm-hmm.
His ambition is nothing less than to solve as president the two largest remaining problems in American society, which is racism and poverty.
Oh, okay.
You can't fault him for his ambition because those were the two biggest problems in American society.
Absolutely.
And he thought we could defeat them both. That's the Great Society. That was the name of his programs.
And the fact that he called it a Great Society openly in the speech where he talks about it first is an amazing revelation. I mean, he's willing to say, I want to help build a great society.
The basic idea is we've settled. The richest country on earth has been okay with these glaring flaws. Let's do something about them.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so he launches the Great Society, which is obviously very controversial to this day.
Mm-hmm.
But he's the one who signs into law also, as part of the Great Society, the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act, two of the greatest sort of legislative triumphs in all of American history, no question.
Mm-hmm.
But what's keeping him back is, of course, the Vietnam stalemate.
Yeah.
By late 1967, we've lost almost 20,000 dead in Vietnam.
20,000, yeah.
You, as an American, you could ignore Vietnam to some extent at first. You can't anymore.
Yeah.
It has forced its way to the center of American politics and American political consciousness.
Yeah.
Important sort of context in 1968 is what happens in late 67 regarding Vietnam, which is the war has become so unpopular. LBJ and his generals deliberately decide to do something about that low popularity.
Oh.
And they launch a public relations campaign.
Huh. You mean one in the United States?
In the United States, trying to build up support for the war. And the way they do it is they basically claim that, famously, there's light at the end of the tunnel, we're about to turn the corner. In other words, we've made massive sacrifices, but it's been worth it.
Yeah, and we can't. We can't let the body count down.
Exactly, and if you look at the body count, the way we measured enemy dead, we are making progress. The sacrifice has been worth it. They may not have said we're winning, but they would say we're turning the corner, and we're sort of on our way to victory. And it works in the short term. The numbers do go back up. If you look at public opinion polling,
late
67, the war becomes more popular, not popular, but, or let me say, less unpopular. So the public relations campaign has an effect. And I say that because that's the important backdrop to the Tet Offensive.
Okay, right.
End of January 1968, all hell breaks loose all across South Vietnam when the Viet Cong, which had been dominant in a lot of the rural areas of South Vietnam, breaks into the cities and towns and launches this massive coordinated attack all across South Vietnam.
And Tet means...
Tet is the Vietnamese Lunar New Year.
Right, okay.
Which is not January 1st, but in this case it was January 31st, 1968.
Yeah.
So they basically come out of the rural areas. They launch these massive attacks all across dozens of cities and towns, including Saigon. Viet Cong sappers actually managed to break into the U.S. Embassy compound in Saigon.
Oh, so that's long before the famous helicopter.
This is the American. It's like in Baghdad today. Actually, it's a physical symbol of American power. It's this sort of fortress-like structure. Well, they managed to fight their way into it. Almost all the Viet Cong involved die, but it takes hours to retake the compound. And this, of course, is all this mayhem is captured on American television.
Which in itself is a big change.
Which is a big change. You know, keep in mind the journalists were given a lot more freedom back then to cover the war.
Yeah.
And militarily, it's actually suicidal on the part of the Viet Cong. Because all of these, over the next months, and by the way, the Tet Offensive leads to this big uptick in combat and U.S. casualties for the first 6 months of 1968. It's not over quickly.
Wow.
Something like, I just saw the stats, something like 16,000 U.S. dead, 16,000 of the American dead in Vietnam are in 1968. It's by far the bloodiest. Wow. It's by far the bloodiest year for the Americans. And remember, the context is important because Americans have been told we're winning, and then this attack takes place, and the enemy demonstrates not only is it not on the ropes, but it has unprecedented strength that can conduct this attack, and that's important because that's why even though it's a military defeat for the Viet Cong, it's a political victory for the Viet Cong.
Oh, okay.
The war immediately becomes much more unpopular.
Yep.
LBJ in February famously loses Walter Cronkite.
Now, this is a fascinating thing because this is a big deal, and we can't imagine nowadays.
Yeah, it's a totally
this sort of thing would be
totally
a big
different
deal.
Media landscape. Remember, that's right. We only had three networks back then.
Yeah.
A lot of Americans, and not just older Americans, got a lot of their information from the evening news, where a lot of them, right? If you don't read a newspaper, you read the evening news over your TV dinner. You watch Huntley and Brinkley, or you watch Walter Cronkite, who was this old, you know, he had this very authoritative voice. Mm-hmm. I mean, everyone believed what he said was gospel. Mm-hmm. And in late February, he gives this long sort of opinion piece on air about Vietnam, in which he says this is a stalemate.
Yes, that's astounding.
And Lyndon Johnson afterwards privately said, basically, this is a basic quotation, if I've lost Walter Cronkite, I've lost the country.
Yes.
That's how important Walter Cronkite was, and LBJ recognized it.
And this is in early 68.
Yeah, late February 68, about a month after the Tet Offensive. Yeah. And this helps fuel this credibility gap. In other words, what's important is not what happens on the battlefield. What's important is you told us we're winning. Clearly, we aren't.
Ah.
And so... And remember, the credibility gap is important. Once again, context is everything. You and I are used to not trusting our politicians. Back then, a lot of people did. A lot of people, just as an article of faith, people believed what the president said.
And I'm sure that FDR didn't have a credibility gap problem when he talked about World War II.
Correct. Okay. Exactly, yeah, right. So. Whereas now, LBJ's got a problem. And LBJ is... increasingly unpopular, even in his own party.
Yeah.
And this is the important thing, because 68 is an election year.
Yes, that's right.
Everyone, including LBJ, knows that he's running again. Remember, he's allowed to do that. You're allowed to serve two terms or 10 years.
As elected, right. Because he wasn't elected technically.
That's right.
In 64.
So he could have served until January 1973.
Yes, that's right.
There's nothing preventing that.
And he had just won a landslide in 64.
He just won a landslide. He, remember, especially back then, if you're an incumbent president, you are the head of your party.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You want to run again, you do.
Mm-hmm.
And so challenging him would have been absurd. It would have been suicidal.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And so in 1967, you had inside the Democratic Party what was called the Dump Johnson movement.
And let me just add one more thing to that, because this is astounding for all sorts of reasons, because it doesn't happen very often. But also, a lot of Democrats, congressmen and senators, had been able to, this may be slight exaggeration, ride the Johnson gravy train.
Correct.
He was probably the greatest legislative leader the United States has had in a long time, and he was able to get his people... you know, good committee positions and on and on and on. So there's would be tons of people loyal to him already.
Right.
But the fact that they're starting to ebb away in 68 is really shocking.
Oh, and you're absolutely right. And also including a lot of freshman senators and especially representatives elected on his coattails in 1964.
Yeah.
And you're right, absolutely right. Remember, the federal government is unprecedentedly large in the mid-60s.
Mm-hmm.
He has many more goodies to give out, right? Federal projects in somebody's district, or no federal projects in somebody's district, right? He's allowed to do that. He's a master at pulling those sorts of strings.
He's very good at it.
So you have a much more disciplined Democratic Party than maybe at any other point in history.
Yeah.
And so bucking Johnson really is absurd. But you do have a dump Johnson movement. It's led by a guy by the name of Allard Lowenstein.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very famous guy in the history of the Democratic Party. He, in mid-67, launches a search for someone who's willing to take on LBJ. Nobody is.
Right.
He goes to Robert F. Kennedy. Robert F. Kennedy essentially says, what are you, high? No. Robert F. Kennedy is ambitious as anybody else. He knows you don't challenge Lyndon Johnson if Lyndon Johnson wants to run again. So
even with the Kennedy name, right.
Lowenstein keeps coming up empty until he hits upon the junior senator from Minnesota, Eugene McCarthy.
Ah, right. Now remember, this is Eugene McCarthy. This is not Joseph McCarthy or any other.
Although it's funny you mention that. There were people in the getting a little ahead of the game. Eugene McCarthy is going to do very well in the New Hampshire primary.
Mm-hmm.
There are Democratic operatives who believe that a lot of people who voted for, or some New Hampshireites who voted for Eugene McCarthy, thought they were voting for Joe McCarthy.
Oh.
Yeah. That's bad. Yeah. I mean, it's wrong in so many levels. Eugene McCarthy, who was not a big name.
No, not at all. No.
By the way, he was a Johnson loyalist.
Senator
up until
from
this point. Minnesota.
Minnesota,
elected in 1958, in that great Democratic year of 1958. He was reelected in 64. He, mid-67, he basically loses it over the Vietnam War.
Yeah, he himself loses it.
He himself loses it. He cannot abide the administration continuing to prosecute a losing war and being lying about it and being arrogant about it.
Mm-hmm.
He just had enough. And so he decides to take up Lowenstein's challenge and announces in late 67 that he's going to run against LBJ.
Now, is this after the Cronkite announcement or before?
No, it's before.
Okay.
No, it's in 67.
He's already
announced that he's running in 67.
Okay.
Most people dismiss him as a crank. Like, basically, what are you thinking? Like,
yeah, it's way too early.
Or at best, they think it's in purely symbolic.
Yeah, okay.
Right? In other words, your way of channeling dissent, but there's no way you're going to make any headway against Lyndon B. Johnson.
Yeah. And it's not like he's going to lose his own Senate seat.
Right.
Because that's not up until much later.
Yeah. He's burning all his bridges with the administration, and he's going to be a pariah in the Democratic Party
by doing this.
Absolutely. But so Lowenstein did find somebody. And then a funny thing happens. At the grassroots, you start to see a lot of young people mobilizing for Eugene McCarthy.
Yes.
And coming in, especially into the New Hampshire primary, you have a lot of youngsters who famously go clean for Gene.
Now, I've always loved this quote, clean for Gene, because it means they're shaving their proto-hippie beards and cutting their hair.
Exactly. Because remember, a lot of young people, including young people who weren't hippies, were growing their hair a little longer, growing sideburns.
But they thought in order to make McCarthy's campaign serious, they had to go clean and make it look like they were clean.
Well,
cut.
Especially keep in mind, they're ringing doorbells in New Hampshire, which is a relatively conservative state, right? And so, the young people become respectable because that's how they are so committed to the cause. And by the way, this is largely, if not entirely, about the Vietnam War.
Right.
We should keep reminding you of it. Johnson's continuing to prosecute the war. A lot of young people in the Democratic Party thinks the war should be ended, so they back a peace candidate in the form of Eugene McCarthy, right? That really is, it's not a single issue campaign, but almost.
And McCarthy campaigns and comes off as a kind of college professor type, a spiritual type. He quotes Emerson, he's always talking about literary things and things that would kill any other political candidate
makes you big with the college campuses.
Yeah, that's
especially
right.
At a time when, remember, college education is still a relatively elite thing.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a lot of young people, affluent white people going to college. I know it's odd now, but as an intellectual endeavor.
Oh, yeah.
Not as a professional endeavor.
Right. Yeah.
And so they find him attractive. Looking back and read any account of 68, he's a really odd candidate.
Yeah,
a really poor candidate. And I have this little anecdote. This was certainly before New Hampshire. There was a big fundraiser he was supposed to attend. And the last minute he pulled out of it. Why? Because he wanted to go watch a movie with an aide. And the movie, and not that anyone cares, but the movie was apparently the film version of James Joyce's Ulysses.
Well.
And McCarthy wanted to find out whether they were actually going to use this particular swear word that was not acceptable in movies at the time. There is your presidential candidate, ladies and gentlemen.
First of all, I'm shocked to hear that there was a movie exactly. version of it. It's the right. longest book
I'm
in Christendom.
I'm thinking it was not a big theatrical release.
No.
But this I mean, that he's not the most disciplined. He doesn't yeah. makes really odd decisions. At certain points, he just loses all enthusiasm. He's just really odd.
But for the fact that he's against the war, or he right. comes out as being against the war early.
Or to put it another way, had he been a really good candidate, who knows what would have happened?
Well, that's true. I didn't think about that, yeah.
But even though he's not the greatest candidate, the fact that he's the only alternative leads to
oh,
what?
I see. Okay, yeah.
The
yeah.
fact that he's the only alternative and that there is an alternative, and yeah, it's even yeah. though it's candidate yeah. X for all a lot of people care,
yeah.
leads to a political earthquake in New Hampshire. And the New Hampshire primary, which was in early March 1968,
mm-hmm.
and people should keep in mind that primaries back then were not nearly, I'll probably mention it again, were not nearly as important as they are now.
Oh, no, there weren't as many of them.
There weren't as many, and they just weren't as important.
No,
I
no,
think
no.
in the Democratic Party in 1968, still half of all delegates are chosen by the old method, you know, with party bosses, party structure,
yeah.
et cetera.
And smoke-filled rooms.
The smoke-filled room, exactly, to wheeling and dealing.
Yeah.
And the other half by primaries.
Yeah.
And even within the primaries, the way they allocate delegates was really skewed. In other words, you might get a majority of the primary votes, but you wouldn't get a majority of the delegates because you won that primary.
So
because
was there enough wheeling and dealing even in the primary system?
Exactly
that, oh, I gotcha.
Right.
Okay,
and it was really skewed toward the party machine and not toward rank-and-file voters.
See, people think draining the swamp is a new thing, but you know, it was a much more
yeah.
political
and as
backwards
we'll
yeah. back then.
Yeah, and as we'll see, largely because of 1968. Anyway, Johnson basically doesn't campaign in New Hampshire.
No, why should he?
Well, yeah. it's beneath him, right?
Yeah.
You don't want
to. Oh, it's beneath. Yeah, sure. Yeah,
you don't want to give McCarthy any credibility by actually running against him. So I don't think LBJ appears in the state once before the primary. LBJ wins the primary, but that's not the important thing. The important thing is the result. He wins, but it's 49-42.
Which, considering all the context, was
stunning.
A McCarthy victory, basically.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they, you know, beforehand, they played the expectations game, like what would amount to a quote-unquote victory for McCarthy.
Oh, right. yeah, yeah,
Everyone
yeah.
agrees that this is an earthquake.
Yeah.
That,
oh, yeah, yeah.
That
yeah.
you got 42%. Now, there's some interesting things here before I forget. Exit polls show that 60% of the votes for McCarthy were people who thought Lyndon Johnson should do more to win the war.
Oh, they were sort of
so this is
Uber
not
hawks.
Yes, this is not an anti-war vote, at least not entirely. This is an anti-Johnson vote. And that would explain, for example, someone thinking they're voting for Joe McCarthy because they'd
right. yeah,
vote
yeah.
for anybody who's not named Lyndon Johnson.
Yeah, okay.
Nevertheless.
To send a message.
To send a message, right? We're unhappy with you. We have all sorts of reasons why we're unhappy with you. Only some of us are unhappy because we think the war is a bad idea.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure some of them thought we, like Curtis LeMay, we should have bombed North Vietnam with nuclear weapons. But still, any way you slice it, it's a stunning result. Any sitting president in that context barely winning a primary.
Yeah.
And it's a barometer, right?
Mm-hmm,
it's like
mm-hmm.
this, it's not just an opinion poll. It's all the primary voters who can be bothered to vote in a single state. A lot of them don't think you should run again.
Yeah, that is shocking.
And then just 4 days later, so that was March 12th. 4 days later, March 16th, Robert F. Kennedy gets in the race.
Well, that's enough of a big sort of news splash in 1968. But when we come back from our sponsorship break we're going to take now, we have an even bigger one. Off to the break, and we'll be back in a moment. Okay, we're back. And Professor, when we left the Democratic Party in this before we went to sponsorship break, LBJ had just technically won New Hampshire, but he also kind of technically lost it to McCarthy.
Right.
So this is what, March
12th,
1968. And then things really start to get interesting.
And just in case I forget to mention it, one of the among the amazing things about 1968 is just the pace of events.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I mean, it is some years in history are overly crammed, like sort of bursting at the seams, like
yeah.
more than a year's worth of events. 1968 is one of those years where if you took out half the things that go on, it would still be an amazing year.
Right, right.
And so these things are just one thing after another. So just 4 days later, March 16th, Robert F. Kennedy, who had refused to enter the race earlier,
right,
now
sure.
gets into the race.
I mean, this is only 4 days.
4 days.
Barely enough time for the newspapers to calm down.
Right. And at the time, RFK takes some heat because now he looks like an opportunist.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Right, right. This is not exactly a profile in courage, I think, to borrow from his brother.
I think this is one of the main reasons why my parents, the Duke and Duchess, were Humphrey people.
Right.
They were the age for the RFK group. They were definitely...
right.
They thought he was an opportunist.
Yeah. Now, I don't know about my parents' feelings about RFK. I know they were huge Humphrey fans, partly because my dad was from Minnesota.
Oh, well, there you go.
But we're getting ahead of the game. Anyway, so RFK joins the race, and that's important, too, partly because of the baggage between RFK and LBJ.
Yeah, not exactly chums.
Oh, my God. One of the most bitter political rivalries in all of American history. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's an exaggeration. Mm-hmm. They loathed each other.
And had to work with each other under the older Kennedy. And then
And
he was Attorney General in the early year.
And briefly under LBJ until he quit to run for the Senate in New York.
Right, right.
During which they made wisecracks about Ich bin ein New Yorker.
I hadn't heard that one.
Which I think is hilarious.
That's good.
Anyway, so RFK enters the race. Just 2 weeks later, speaking of this pace of events, 2 weeks later, LBJ shocks the world, and I'm deliberately using that phrase, shocks the world by, on live television, withdrawing from the race.
And some of his political advisors and the speechwriters didn't know that he was going to say that at the end of a speech about something else.
Nobody knew what was coming.
Yeah.
Even his advisors in the room were blown away.
Yeah.
Partly, they should have known something was up when he began the speech by saying, tonight I want to talk to you about peace in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Because the original text said, I want to talk to you about the war in Vietnam. So he telegraphed his punch, and he famously announces that he will neither seek nor accept the nomination for president from his party.
So again, let's run it. It's only 2 weeks, 14 days. He withdraws. The LBJ withdraws.
Right.
It is stunning.
Yeah, yeah. It was a shock to everybody. His argument at the time is that seeking peace in Vietnam, and he also announces a partial bombing halt and basically a genuine commitment to getting peace talks started.
Right.
And his argument is, and it's a decent argument. His argument is, I don't want domestic politics to get in the way of seeking peace in Vietnam. I don't want to be having sort of the campaign hanging over my head while I'm trying to seek peace.
Because seeking peace was a job in itself.
Exactly. And you don't want domestic politics interfering in that process.
No.
So, and that's his claim. Now, obviously, the bigger reality is he's been mortally wounded by the war and he recognizes it.
Yeah, okay.
And he doesn't want to go through the humiliation of there being a fight over the nomination.
Yeah.
And maybe a fight that he loses.
Yeah, that would be something. That would be amazing.
That would be humiliated. This way, he ducks out on his own terms.
And can say that it's about the war.
Exactly right. He can say it's about the war. It's not a lie.
No.
It's a genuine argument, but there's more to it than he lets on at the time. But clearly, the Vietnam War has claimed its highest ranking casualty at this point, if I can put it that way.
Holy cow.
It's a stunning decision. It's a turning point in American history in so many ways. So now, you've got an interesting campaign shaping up, but just 4 days later, April 4th, 1968, another earth-shattering event of an entirely different type when Martin Luther King Jr. is assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah, not only is the pace astounding, but sometimes I think, and you and I were only, 5 or 6 years old or whatever, it's amazing the country didn't tear itself apart.
Yeah.
Just in the early part of the year.
And we're just getting started.
I know.
I mean, keep in mind that this is only, not even 5 years after the assassination of a president.
That's right.
An earth-shattering event that had scarred Americans.
Yeah, sure.
For years and years and years. And now it's like now another major figure is assassinated. And this was, he had run into trouble in terms of the progress of the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
But his assassination, this man of peace, right? The greatest nonviolent figure in all of American history is erased in a violent act.
Yeah.
And we shouldn't be surprised to find out that after years of urban riots and problems in the inner city, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that it leads to another wave of urban riots.
Yeah.
Places like, today in 2018, you can go to parts of Washington, D.C. that have not recovered from the 1968 riots 50 years later.
That's astounding.
There's still areas of economic blight. But also Baltimore, Chicago, other cities, you have huge rioting because of the rage and frustration, right? It's like we've got our great nonviolent leader who remains nonviolent to his last breath, and he's taken away by violence.
Yep.
Why wouldn't you react with rage?
Yeah.
It's unfortunate but understandable.
So, but that leaves us with this now odd landscape where the president has withdrawn from the a great moral leader is now out of the public discourse.
Right. And within the context of the Democratic campaign, you no longer have two challengers facing an incumbent, but you have two challengers facing each other.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. Right? Well, the dynamic
changes entirely. Right now, you've got Robert F. Kennedy against Eugene McCarthy going state by state and sort of slugging it out, and both of them win certain primaries.
Mm-hmm.
And then this is just what? This is 2 months later.
Yeah.
Literally hours after winning the California primary, which was a big deal.
Yeah. And only minutes after making a speech to his supporters about it.
That's right. Robert F. Kennedy himself is assassinated in the Ambassador Hotel. So this is in the very early morning hours of June 5th, 1968. In fact, mm-hmm. we just marked its 50th anniversary.
Yeah.
Another cataclysmic, tragic event in American history. So a second Kennedy is killed.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, that alone is shocking enough.
Right. Now, there had been very, very high hopes for his campaign. He, if you look at the pictures of the crowds that he attracts when he's mm-hmm. on the campaign trail, they are amazing. He's got the Kennedy mystique. In some ways, he makes better connection with rank-and-file voters than his brother ever did.
Yeah, that's interesting because...
It's a real interesting thing.
Yeah.
Especially young people.
Yeah.
And certainly racial minorities.
Yeah.
Hispanics and African-Americans really do sort of warm up to him. He relies heavily on them for the victories he scores, including in California. However, I would like to take a moment here to sort of knock down what I think is a myth.
Well, that's what we do here.
That's what we do here on occasion. Certainly a misconception. I think a lot of people, and perfectly understandably, a lot of people extrapolate. They assume that if Robert F. Kennedy is not assassinated, that he would A, get the nomination, and then B, win the presidency.
Yeah.
Had he gotten the nomination... He might have won the presidency.
Right.
We don't know. It's possible. My point here would be that it's very difficult to see him getting the nomination.
Yeah, the numbers don't stack up.
First of all, McCarthy was, from all indications, going to stay in the race,
yeah.
even though he lost in California.
Yeah.
That's one thing. And once again, what I said a minute ago, it's not about primaries. It's about delegates.
No, that's right.
And the idea that the Democratic Party establishment...
Mm-hmm.
and or Lyndon Johnson would sit idly by and watch Robert F. Kennedy get the nomination,
yeah.
really hard to fathom.
And the if you will, the anti-war side of the Democratic Party is split now between two
yes.
candidates, and the administration side is still together.
That's right.
So you've got...
And there are other things at work here, too. Let's often overlook, let's keep in mind that Robert F. Kennedy had very poor support among organized labor.
Yeah, oh, sure, yeah. Yeah.
So, in other words, any Democratic candidate has to try and put together what's called the New Deal coalition.
Mm-hmm.
He would have had some trouble.
Yeah.
So, was it possible he'd get the nomination? Sure.
Yeah.
Not at all assured. Mm-hmm. So, obviously it's an enormous tragedy in a million ways.
Of course, yeah.
But let's not assume that therefore he would have gotten the nomination.
In fact, I think most historians of this period, and especially political scientists who are doing, among other things, number counting, say he wouldn't have.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And like I said...
But again, that's speculation, so
right.
we don't...
Exactly. But you can't make an assumption one way or another.
What's happening on the other side,
right.
the Republican side?
Often overlooked because of all this tumult among Democrats
yeah.
is what's going on among Republicans. I'm not going to go into the details, but it was a contested nomination, as it certainly would be, especially at the end of 8 years of the other party, right? That's when everyone wants to be a challenger
yeah.
because they know historically their chances are good.
Mm-hmm. Because after all, JFK would have been president until 68.
That's right. Exactly.
Yeah.
And then
that's 8 years.
Right. And he would have been in Eisenhower's position in 1960.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
And historically, it's just very hard for any party, forget about candidates, parties to keep hold of the White House for more than two terms in a row. So you do have people lining up, people like George Romney,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Mitt Romney's father, by the way,
mm-hmm.
a governor of Michigan,
mm-hmm.
strong candidate at one point. He infamously, and in a way unfairly, he's targeted for this, but he, like a lot of politicians, went to Vietnam, right, to sort of take the tour and to be led around.
Yeah.
And he came back and said publicly, I've been brainwashed on the subject of Vietnam.
Ah.
What he meant was that he had been given the sort of pat presentations that said everything's going great.
Okay.
What it sounded like is he was no longer his own person on the Vietnam War issue.
Oh, yeah, that's right. So people thought he wasn't himself.
Right.
Yeah,
right. Now, his campaign collapsed for other reasons, too, but that certainly didn't help.
It wasn't as well known as the other ones you're about to talk about.
Certainly not. Yeah. Certainly not as well known as Nelson Rockefeller.
Right. Another candidate. Another Republican candidate.
Who had been a candidate in 1960 and 64. And if you he's another very puzzling candidate because he's so wishy-washy.
Yeah, which is surprising because he has almost everything going for him except his divorce.
Exactly. His divorce is a problem. In retrospect, another problem is he's just too liberal. He's from the liberal wing of the Republican Party, and he would have alienated conservatives in the Republican Party. Mm-hmm. But he's also he's way too coy. He's way too wishy-washy. At certain points, he basically makes it clear he doesn't want to run, where secretly he does and wants to be drafted.
Yeah.
Right? In other words, it's the old thing. You want people to want you, but you don't want to look like you want it yourself, that kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I want people to want me, but he's not flaky. Like, he's not the Republican version of McCarthy.
No. Okay. No. But his, basically, for a bunch of reasons, candidacy fizzles. Mm-hmm. At one point, Ronald Reagan is sort of a dark horse.
Yes, that's right.
Which is interesting, right? He's going to get the nomination in 1980. He comes really close in 1976 against Gerald Ford. Mm-hmm. But he's also in the mix in 1968. He's only been governor of California for not even 2 years, like a year and a half. But he's a very popular figure.
Yes, yes.
Including among a lot of Southerners.
Right, right.
He has very strong support in the party. Successfully swatting away all these threats one by one is none other than Richard Nixon.
Yep, our friend from 1960.
Our friend from 1960. It's a cliche, but there's something to it. It's an amazing political comeback.
Absolutely, absolutely.
I'd have to give it some thought. I can't think of another major political figure in American history who's so thoroughly damaged and then goes on to success.
Now, Buskiller shouldn't forget, he loses the close election in 1960 for president. Then he loses the governorship,
right,
the governor race in California in 62. So it's almost as if Richard were sending you a message.
Yeah. Yeah,
you
know. And even him running for the governorship against Pat Brown in 1962
was crazy. Yeah.
Everyone's like, are you that desperate for office?
Yeah, right.
I mean, it was considered kind of pathetic. And then you'll lose.
Yeah, right.
And then he famously gives his quote unquote last press conference when he infamously says that the press won't have him to kick around anymore.
And this is a man who'd been vice president.
He had been vice president. Yeah. He'd been a very effective and prominent member of the House of Representatives. Mm. He'd been in the U.S. Senate. Mm-hmm. He was one of our leading lights. He actually had a pretty good record as vice president, even.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he was given up for dead. The ABC actually ran a documentary called, I think it was 1964, or maybe it was 1963. I think it was shortly after he lost the governorship race in California. It was called The Political Obituary of Richard Nixon.
Oh, that's a bit...
That's kind of like putting a jinx in a way. It's like, now you know he's going to be president, right?
Yeah.
But straight up, they're just like declaring him politically dead. Well, this is Richard Nixon, by the way,
who's
basically a pit bull.
Yeah, lives forever.
And everything he does after 1962 is about him trying to get back into the White House. Or trying to get into the White House.
Mm-hmm.
For example, in 1964, even though he's not a big Barry Goldwater fan, he goes up and down the country being the good soldier, collecting all sorts of political debts, making speeches for candidates at all levels, including Goldwater, and establishing his ties to the whole party nationwide and to both wings of the party nationwide.
Yeah, but I was going to say, because Nixon is a lot more moderate than Goldwater was.
Exactly. Well, and that's part of Nixon's strength, is that someone like Rockefeller, Nixon can plausibly maintain ties. It's sort of like actually Franklin Roosevelt in the context of the Democratic Party in the 20s and early 30s. Successful candidates are the ones who don't burn bridges.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
They're the ones who collect debts across the political spectrum. Nixon also hires some very good people, including Roger Ailes.
Yes, a young Roger Ailes.
A very young Roger Ailes. And Nixon tried deliberately to learn from his mistakes from 1960.
Right.
Runs a quote-unquote modern campaign, one that's largely on television.
Right, right.
And it's very, very effective.
Nixon now.
Nixon's the one, right? It's a very, like FDR in 1932,
sure,
by the way,
sure.
A very vague,
aspirational,
wishy-washy campaign. It almost costs him election, actually, that he doesn't take stances on issues.
Uh-huh.
He's all over the map on all the major issues, gives vague statements. What he cleverly does, and this is important long-term, is that he, certainly more than previous candidates, discovers what you and I would call the dog whistle.
Yes,
which
absolutely.
Is you make racist or bigoted appeals without appearing to do so.
Yeah.
And the way you do that in 1968, and he does it better than anyone else, is he talks about law and order.
Yeah.
And he implies, if he doesn't actually say, under the Democrats, crime has gone up, your lives have become less secure.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and by the way, the government is spending a lot of your tax money on people who are rioting.
Yeah.
Which is a gross oversimplification and really, I would argue, unfair depiction of the situation.
Right.
But it's incredibly effective.
Oh, absolutely.
And he does it through subtle references, for example, Law and Order.
Yeah. Right. And later in the election, he's going to win over some Democrats.
Is exactly right.
But, one of the things, of course, the Buzzkillers and almost everyone else will think about 1968 is there's a reason we're talking about the Republicans this long is because it's overlooked, whereas the Democrats having this big turmoil with multiple candidates and then the riot and then the problems in the convention are so, newsworthy, historically speaking. The Republican convention in Miami is not exactly, a walk in the park. It's not, it's tense.
No, it is tense. There are backroom deals.
Yeah.
There's a lot of anxiety in the Nixon camp that this might go south somehow. They manage it. But you're right. I mean, the Democratic convention gets all the attention,
yeah.
But it's not like the one in Miami Beach was any sort of just, foregone conclusion.
It's before the Democratic convention, and so it gets swamped by that drama. But it would, if it hadn't been for Chicago, it would have been seen as a tense thing.
Yes, absolutely. And the Nixon people were sweating it at certain points.
Yeah.
No question about it. They weren't sweating it like Hubert Humphrey was.
No.
And Hubert Humphrey, he's...
we've been leaving him out of this.
We've been leaving him out. I mean, I forget exactly when he declares. It is later than some of the other candidates.
But he is, of course, the most moderate, the most...
He's the most
mainstream.
Moderate. He is, I would argue, he's the vice president, by the way.
Yeah.
Once again, we had this odd gap where there was no vice president.
Yeah,
but he is LBJ's... 64. Right. He's LBJ's running mate in 64. He had been a very effective and very prominent, very popular senior senator from Minnesota, first mm-hmm. elected in 1948 mm-hmm. after being the mayor of Minneapolis.
Yeah.
He's a tragic figure in so many ways.
Yeah.
In one sense, he's too loyal to LBJ.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's a trooper. He understand if you want to be president and you're LBJ's vice president, that's what you have to do. You have to be 100% loyal. You have to own the Vietnam War, even though you don't want to.
Right. Right.
He's also tragic because he's walking into this situation, which is just total chaos,
mm-hmm.
right? The Democratic base is much more splintered than the Republican base is.
Yeah, absolutely.
And in a way, he's a politician from an earlier age.
Yeah.
He's a classic New Deal Democrat.
Yeah.
In every way. And in 1968, it turns out that's not well suited to the situation.
Yeah, he's like another FDR, and we're not even talking about the convention yet. But of course, RFK is out of the race, so he's really only running against McCarthy
who
the establishment thinks was even more flaky and more danger than
there
RFK would have been.
This shocked me, but there is a brief moment where they're actually talking about drafting Ted Kennedy to run.
Yes, that's right. That's right. George McGovern was sort of...
Right. That's right. George McGovern was thinking about it, but Ted Kennedy was not even 40 years old, I think.
Yeah.
And, he had been a senator since 1963, but it's almost like these Democrats are desperate to have a Kennedy somehow.
Yeah, it's really too bad.
And partly because of the dissatisfaction with the other candidates.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
Right? I mean, if you don't like Eugene McCarthy and you don't want this old guard Democrat, Hubert Humphrey, mm-hmm. what do you do? In any case, so we go into Chicago, late August, 1968. And the important thing here, at least in terms of causing mayhem, is the anti-war movement and the youth movement deliberately decide to target the Democratic National Convention and Chicago at the same time.
Right, right.
Large numbers of young people descend on Chicago, including the Yippies.
Mm-hmm.
Not the hippies, the Yippies, the Youth International Party.
Right.
They nominate a pig.
Yeah,
this is Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman. Often, this is not about political success. This is about notoriety and throwing a wrench in the works. In any case... I'm not going to go into the details, but on national television for more than one night, you have complete bedlam in the streets of Chicago and largely caused by the police.
Mm-hmm.
Everything I've read, including the official studies of the event, describe this as a police riot
mm-hmm.
where the police forces of Mayor Daley, remember he's the old school party boss who runs Chicago, and runs the national convention, the Democratic National Convention, by the way.
And is a big deal in the Democratic Party.
And is an enormous deal in the Democratic Party. Yeah. His police force basically declares open season, not just on protesters, but anyone who gets in their way.
Yeah.
They wail with their nightsticks on journalists and on passersby and on innocent tourists who are leaving the hotel, and is all captured on national television. In fact, the protesters at certain points famously chant, "The whole world is watching." It was true.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And this is going to be one of the reasons long term for the Democratic defeat in 1968.
Yeah.
Is that this party, even though they successfully, after a lot of tumult inside the convention as well.
Oh, sure. Someone makes a big speech about, we're going to move forward and not have Gestapo tactics in the streets of Chicago.
Yes, that's Abe Ribicoff, Senator from Connecticut, I believe, who then is, I don't know if it was captured on TV at the time, but then...
Yes, it is. Daily calls him a dirty Jew bastard or something like that.
Yeah.
Lip readers among you buzzkillers can tell what he's saying.
Yes. It's ugliness all the way around.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. To accuse the mayor's police of Gestapo tactics, even if it's true, by the way.
Yeah, not the smartest.
That's going to get a rise out of the mayor. And basically, my point here is that the Democratic Party is saddled with all of this chaos out in the streets.
Yeah, that's right.
So, I mean, the chaos is emblematic of the 60s in general,
mm-hmm.
but it's also a big problem short-term for the Democratic Party.
And so, ironically, they have among the mildest candidates you could possibly have, which is Hubert Humphrey.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah. So Humphrey does get the nomination, which he was probably going to get anyway.
Yeah.
But now he comes out of this convention sort of a damaged figure.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. If you can't control your own party, how are you going to expect
right.
to be?
And last thing I'll say about this is it doesn't help that LBJ, in the whole sweep of the campaign, is not the best incumbent you want behind you.
No, that's right.
If you are the VP running in your own right.
He campaigns for him.
LBJ is... First of all, he's keeping Humphrey on a short leash,
yeah.
insisting that Hubert Humphrey continue to own the Vietnam War. And LBJ, in my view, is more interested in preserving his own legacy than in making sure a Democrat is elected in 1968.
Yeah,
I think that's a painful reality.
Well, we're going to take a station ID break here because, as you can imagine, if those of you, especially the young buzzkillers out there, it can't get any more chaotic and weird than this, but it's about to. But we're going to talk about our own personal needs in Buzzkill Nation now on Station ID. Back in a second.
Hello, this is Sebastian Buzzkill. Please support my daddy by going to ProfessorBuzzkill.com and clicking on the Patreon button. While you're there, subscribe to his email list and shop the Buzzkill bookshelf. Follow him on Facebook, on Twitter, at BuzzkillProf, and on Instagram, at ProfessorBuzzkill. Professor Buzzkill is part of Entertainment One's podcast network. It's available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and all major podcast apps. Please leave a review while you're there. Thanks for listening.
Okay, we're back. And I promised, of course, to all of you that things would get even wilder. I can't imagine how they could get wilder, the Chicago Convention in 68. But something extra happens. Professor, what is that?
Exactly. As you're suggesting, it's weird enough on its own, this election, and it gets a lot weirder because this is one of those elections that not only has a third party candidate, that's actually pretty common,
yeah,
but a very viable and successful third party candidate,
right,
in the
right.
form of George Wallace,
right,
former famous or infamous as the former governor of Alabama. This is
right.
this is the segregationist governor who stood in the schoolhouse door.
Yep.
This is the one who, when he was inaugurated governor, January 1963, famously said, "Segregation now, yeah. segregation tomorrow, and segregation forever."
Yeah.
So everyone knows what he stands for.
Yeah.
He runs as a third party candidate, and he immediately gets a lot of traction.
And runs kind of as a law and order candidate too. Yeah.
A law and order candidate who shows his fangs. Let me put it that way.
A law and venom candidate.
Right. He doesn't necessarily run on. Everyone knows he's segregationist.
Yeah.
He doesn't run on that.
No.
He basically runs against the 1960s.
Yeah. Okay. And what the 60s have become
exactly,
by 1968.
And basically he runs on behalf of those who resent all of the chaos, all of the youth rebellion, the civil rights movement, all that we associate with the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
He runs against that.
And you would think that
openly,
you know, he would only have strength in his sort of native South, but that's not true.
No, indeed. He attracts huge crowds.
Yeah.
He spoke at Boston Common, okay, in the belly of the liberal beast,
yeah,
and attracted 20,000 people.
20,000 in a cramped city like Boston, that's hard to do.
Now, that's a big crowd. Now, let's also, in fairness, let's keep in mind that most places, including there, he is also attracting a lot of protesters.
Okay, right. Oh, yeah, yeah.
Which partly he wants to do.
Oh, that's a good idea. That's a sort of backhanded strategy.
Well, I mean, as a Marxist would say, he's someone who wants to sharpen the contradictions.
yeah.
Right? In other words, he loves appealing to people and then being able at a rally to point to the long hairs, as he would call them, right? To point to the protest and see, this is what I'm running against, right? Because in a way, they play right into his hands by screaming at him, by holding the signs with super left-wing slogans on them, etc. So it becomes really good theater, but he also attracts a lot of support. He threatens protesters. On the stump, he basically says, when I'm elected, I'm going to get in my presidential limousine and run over protesters.
That's just shocking.
Or if a protester sits down in front of my car, that's the last car they're going to sit down in front of. He says this in public to great applause.
Yeah.
So clearly he's tapped into something.
And one attracts a lot of sort of law and order Democrats, law and order Republicans,
which you might call
Archie Bunker types.
Right, exactly. Yeah. Exactly right. And so, and it is ironic, let's just keep this in focus. He's arguing for law and order much more strongly than Nixon, and yet fistfights are always breaking out at his rallies. it's a little ironic, but he rides that wave. And there's one point, I believe it's in August, there's one point where he is only trailing Humphrey in the polls by 7 points.
This is astounding.
This is a
sitting vice president.
This is an open segregationist. Mm-hmm. This is a third party candidate running with more baggage than in the luggage hold of a 747.
Yeah.
And here he is just 7 points behind the incumbent vice president,
which is exactly the margin by which McCarthy almost caught Nixon in the New Hampshire primary, and people talked about
Johnson, almost caught Johnson.
Almost caught Johnson, and people called that a great McCarthy victory.
Yeah, exactly.
So in a way, you're headed for a great Wallace victory.
Now, by the way, just parenthetically, this is also bad news for Nixon.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Because Wallace is taking a lot of votes away from Nixon.
That's right, yeah.
And until very late in the game, Nixon's nightmare is that Wallace's presence gets enough electoral votes to deny Nixon 270.
Yeah.
And our constitutional scholars listening will know that if a candidate doesn't get to 270 electoral votes, the election is thrown to the House.
House of Representatives.
Where each state votes as a unitary block.
And there are more Democrats.
And there were more Democrats. Yeah. So if it is a fact that if Nixon doesn't get to 270, Hubert Humphrey becomes president.
Yeah, yeah.
That would have happened. By the way, that has happened in American history. It's gone to the House
more than once.
Right. Not recently.
Early on, yeah.
Early on it happened. Yeah.
But still, that's astounding that Nixon's worried about.
Yeah, he really is. And the dynamic of the race changes a great deal at the end of September.
Okay, so we're not getting close to November, but it's moving along.
And if you look at people talk about the Humphrey campaign, they basically talk about the wasted September, where he's continuing to embrace the war, and he continues to struggle, and big parts of the traditional Democratic coalition just are not rallying to Humphrey. And he changes course at the end of September. He gives a famous speech in Salt Lake City. Where he finally, however you want it, he grows a spine, he throws the dice, he gets tired of being hammered in the polls, whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
He basically breaks with LBJ and declares his support for a partial bombing halt to get the peace talks with the North Vietnamese back on track.
Right.
It's a what if. Had he done this 2 weeks, 4 weeks earlier, he might very well have won the election. And I can say that because of how close the election is going to be.
Oh, yeah. That's another big misunderstanding people have
this
about 68.
This had a bunch of effects. It rallied people. His crowd started growing a lot. Young people started paying attention to him and overcame their distaste for his traditional aspect. He starts raising money at a much higher rate. And Democratic constituencies, particularly organized labor, start returning to the fold. Some of them had been sitting on the sidelines. Some of them had been flirting with Nixon. Some of them had been flirting with Wallace. They start to return to the Humphrey fold.
And that's a big deal.
That's a huge deal. That's going to be a big reason why the election ends up being so close. But once he breaks with Johnson on the war, he starts climbing steadily in the polls. It helps the fact that in early October, the Wallace campaign implodes. because and that's the word for it, implodes, yeah. because of his famous selection of a running mate, none other than former General Curtis LeMay.
Yeah, who famously says, basically, we should use nuclear weapons.
We shouldn't use... Yeah, he gives this infamous press conference October 3rd, I believe, and I believe it was in Pittsburgh.
All right.
And Wallace is there and just... beside himself.
Can't believe he's saying he's so extreme.
Yeah, and he keeps trying to intervene. And let's just put it this way. LeMay is not a politician. He was very cavalier about the use of nuclear weapons.
To say the least, yeah.
And about the impacts of nuclear war.
Right.
And reporters were stunned.
More or less saying, if we've got nuclear weapons, we should use
them. Right, like, yeah. Why wouldn't you use them?
Yeah, that's
right. Which, I mean, you know, Eisenhower at certain points said essentially the same thing.
Yeah.
But in that context... he is just considered beyond the pale.
Yeah.
Wallace chose him because he wanted some foreign policy credibility.
Yeah.
It didn't work out. Wallace's support collapses, not entirely, as we'll see, but it does collapse. His numbers start to sag. I think Humphrey probably would have gained some votes in October at Wallace's expense anyway.
Right, but LeMay makes it easier.
But LeMay makes it a lot easier for people to say, well, boy, this guy really is a kook. I mean... You know, what if the election is thrown to the House, Wallace gets elected president, and then he gets assassinated? President LeMay. Repeat those words together for several times and see how that sounds.
Because after all, Wallace does get shot.
He does. In 1972, later. He gets shot and almost killed. That is correct.
That's the Dixiecrat Party, right?
No, actually, I think they're called the American Independence Party.
Okay, right.
You're right. A lot of their supporters are former Dixiecrats. 1948 was the Dixiecrat Revolt, where Strom Thurmond...
Oh, 1948, of course. Sorry,
Strom Thurmond.
AIDS mixed up.
Right. Then a Democrat bolts because the Democratic Party embraces civil rights, largely because of Hubert Humphrey, actually. It's all connected.
But what's happening... Well, we're having all this exciting stuff on the one side. What's happening on the Republican side?
On the Republican side, the important thing to know, and I'm not going to get into it, because we're going to talk about...
Oh, yeah, we have another show planned for this, because it's big enough for one.
It deserves its own, and partly because it's getting a lot of attention among historians now, because it's been definitively established that the Nixon administration behind the scenes was working to torpedo the Vietnam peace talks in order for Nixon to get elected.
Right.
That's not supposition
anymore.
For a long, long time, we thought we had some circumstantial evidence, or we weren't completely convinced. Now we're convinced.
Yeah.
And that is so important, it deserves its own show.
This is a political, running for president, basically making backroom deals with the North Vietnamese.
If it's not treason, it's certainly a violation of U.S. law.
And that law is?
That would be the Logan Act.
It's been around for a long time.
You are not, in a nutshell, as a private citizen, you are not allowed to conduct your own foreign policy.
That's right.
And there are good reasons for that.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, in any case, that is so important, it deserves its own show.
Yeah.
It clearly played a role.
Yeah, yeah.
In a close election, because Johnson had announced great progress in the peace talks, and the South Vietnamese had agreed to take part, and then they withdrew. And they withdrew because of Nixon's behind-the-scenes shenanigans.
Yeah, yeah. You get a better deal with me, is basically what he was saying.
Exactly, right. So we'll talk about that on another show. So we get to Election Day, November 5th, I believe, second Tuesday, whatever, of November. The date's not important. Hubert Humphrey comes close to winning, but not quite. Now, as usual, the popular vote is closer.
Yeah, that's right.
In this case, it was super close. The percentages are Nixon gets 43.2%.
Yeah.
Humphrey gets 42.6%. So 0.7 separates them in the popular vote.
Right.
If you're wondering why doesn't that come close to 100, it's because George Wallace takes 12.9.
Oh, is it that big? I didn't realize it's that big. Okay.
Despite his problems,
he
gets 12.9% of the
shocking.
Vote. It's one of the most successful third-party showings in all of American history.
Yeah,
I would argue it alone makes 1968 a really important election, long-term.
Mm-hmm.
And let's also keep in mind the factoid that half of his support came from outside the South.
Half?
Half.
Oh, Lordy.
Includes thousands and thousands of Yankees whose ancestors fought for the Union, who are voting for the public symbol of segregationism.
Right.
So that speaks volumes about the American political landscape in 1968. He also, by the way, takes some electoral votes.
Oh, okay.
Often doesn't happen with third-party candidates.
No, because they don't have enough state.
Nature of our system, right?
How does the Electoral College vote break down?
It's actually pretty close to some recent results. Nixon gets 301.
Uh-huh.
So it's not like it's like 272 or whatever.
Right, yeah. It's not just barely. Yeah.
I mean, it's not a landslide in the Electoral College, not even close. He has a comfortable victory. 301. Humphrey gets 191. Wallace gets 46.
46 is a lot.
It's a lot. He takes the Deep South, or most of the Deep South. He takes Arkansas, and he takes one electoral vote in North Carolina. Because occasionally we split electoral votes in history. Right, it's rare these days. So it's super, super close. Like I said, that 0.7 separating Humphrey and Nixon, assuming they are distributed in the right way, leads me to believe that had Humphrey distanced himself from the war earlier, it might have been enough to put him over the top.
Okay.
A lot of people aren't warming to Nixon for lots of reasons. He himself has some baggage.
Yeah.
He maintains his ties to the various wings of the Republican Party. A lot of non-Republicans and independents don't trust him.
No.
He doesn't seem to stand for very much. He makes a lot of vague declarations on all sorts of issues, including Vietnam. But he doesn't have to win.
No. Yeah. Go ahead.
That short term, that alone, once again, forget about Wallace, makes 1968 a hugely important year because we know what happens next.
Okay, all this tension and sort of party overthrow, not overthrow, but well, they overthrew Johnson.
Right.
What does it lead to?
It leads to a Nixon presidency, which at the time wasn't necessarily earth-shattering, but look what happens with Vietnam. The fact that the Vietnam War drags on.
And many more Americans die.
About 20,000 more Americans die in a war that we're allegedly getting out of.
Yeah.
It leads to Watergate.
Yeah.
Right? Once again, additional cataclysmic events are set up by this event.
Mm-hmm.
That's just short-term.
Yeah.
Short-term, it also leads to the Democrats changing their nominating process.
Oh, okay.
And making it much more small-D Democratic.
Yeah.
And that leads directly to the nomination of George McGovern.
In 72.
Who is the mirror image of Goldwater in 64.
Yeah, right.
In 64, you have a moderate Johnson running against an extremist Goldwater, and it's a blowout.
Yeah.
1972 is the reverse. You have an apparent moderate in Nixon against a sort of extreme anti-war candidate in McGovern, and McGovern gets thumped.
But this also means that the backroom dealing no longer exists.
No longer exists. In recent years, for those keeping track at home, in recent years, they've brought back some of the dealing in the form of things like superdelegates.
Oh, yes, that's right. I forgot. Superdelegates are effectively that.
That is an effort to roll back the McGovern-era reforms that had put, in the eyes of party elders, put too much power in the hands of the people.
Gosh.
And the people can't be trusted to nominate the right candidates all the time. At least that's their view. And so we go to think, and the struggle continues, by the way.
This is
an ongoing debate, particularly among Democrats.
So what then are the long-term effects?
Longer term, this points the way to the modern era in our politics in certain ways. Mm-hmm. One would be McCarthy's campaign, even though he failed, really lights a fire under the whole get out the vote grassroots politics model.
Where it's
retail politics, not just by the candidate, by the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
You don't just rely on TV ads.
Yeah.
You go door to door, you make personal contact with people who are just like you, and you get out the vote that way. McCarthy sort of set that whole trend in motion in a big, big way.
Right.
The Nixon campaign really led us to the modern phenomenon of relying on television.
Yeah, sort of ironically.
Yeah, ironically. You saw it already to some extent, right?
The
quote-unquote new politics involving television and image is really launched by JFK more than anyone. Uh-huh. Nixon takes it to an entirely new level. There's a reason why we have a book about the 1968 campaign called The Selling of the President.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
That's all about the Nixon campaign in particular. Because Nixon, for example, would for the first time, deliberately stage public events,
mm-hmm.
not to reach the people in the crowd, but to reach people on TV.
Yeah.
And so you film the public event and you edit it to make it look like, for example, he has a great connection with the crowd, even though he doesn't.
Yeah, that's right.
That sort of thing.
And those Nixon Now ads are certainly very populist looking.
Right. Let's not forget, I think this was a first. He wasn't the only candidate in 68. And he had a joke candidate in 68, Pat Paulson.
Let's not forget him. Yeah.
But Nixon famously puts in a cameo appearance on Rowan and Martin Laughing,
which is
one of the most popular, if not the most popular, TV show of the era, where he says, "Sock it to me."
Yeah, which I look at it, it looks odd, but I guess it was funny back then.
He can't even do comedy right. Yeah. But yeah, and then, well, I mean, look at our politics today.
Yeah.
I mean,
oh, you've got to go on Jimmy Kimmel.
Yeah,
you've got to go
exactly
on.
Exactly right. You can see the roots of that in 68. You also, much more importantly and substantively, I was talking about process and form in terms of substance. The Nixon campaign, especially the extent to which the Nixon campaign is about dog whistles,
yeah,
is about Wallace without the fangs, or yeah. Wallace with a happy face, or whichever.
Ah, another type of Southern strategy.
The Southern strategy, capital S, is launched by Richard Nixon. You tap into white resentment,
mm-hmm.
White racial bigotry, without using openly racist appeals. Right. That has defined our politics ever since. It certainly defines our politics today.
Yeah.
That is discovered and put into action in 1968 by Richard Nixon and in a different way by George Wallace.
Wow.
So that points the way. The final thing I'll say is that in some ways, the 1968 represents the death of the New Deal coalition that had served Democrats so well for so long.
Right, right.
This sort of
50 years in its own way. Yeah,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, FDR puts it in place and Democrats, including Truman, including Kennedy, including LBJ, mm-hmm. they all benefit from mm-hmm. it. It's unfair to put this on Humphrey's shoulders, but Humphrey sort of marks the sort of the demise of the New Deal coalition.
Okay.
You'll
okay.
see pieces of it again here and there. You'll see sort of echoes of it here and again, but it's never going to show the same strength. It has been effectively broken up by Nixon and Wallace.
Wow. 50 years ago, but still.
Very much with us.
The reverberations.
Absolutely.
All the time. Well, thank you very much, Professor. And Buzzkillers, please think of 1968 when you're going out and voting in 2018. Talk to you next week.